Well, thanks to the organizers for the invitation. It's great to be back and to hold this once more. So I'll be talking about quantum gravity and its connection to observations. And my starting point is just to re-emphasize that the connection between theory and between experiment and observations, which is really an absolutely critical connection in all of sciences, that is also an absolutely necessary connection to make in physics. And if there is a research field in which the connection between theory and experiment is difficult to make, then that difficulty is not a reason to just say, oh, well, maybe we can just give up on the connection and just work purely on the theory side and just build our theories based on sort of intrinsic theory arguments. And of course, a field where this connection is difficult to make is quantum gravity, and I think that's probably the main reason and why we have all of these approaches that Nyayesh had on his slide. And we don't understand whether any of these approaches has any connection to reality. And also, we don't understand whether these approaches are related to each other, whether they are distinct, or whether they might just be mathematically distinct versions of writing the same physics. And I believe all of these questions can be cleared up if we manage to actually make that connection to experiment and observations. So with that, let's just go into that question. Why is it actually so challenging to test quantum gravity? And of course, you'll tell me, well, it's a question of the scale, obviously, right? So we all know that quantum gravity affects Saturn at the Planck scale, which is really tiny as a length scale or very high as an energy scale. Now, where do we actually get that scale and that estimate from? Well, we get it from something like the Bronstein cube, where we can arrange all our theories of fundamental physics, and where we have the Newton coupling for GR, 1 over the speed of light for relativistic effects, and H bar for quantum effects. And so quantum gravity sits at this elusive corner over here, and we can combine these three constants of nature into this unique length scale. And so this is how we arrive at this estimation that that should be the scale at which quantum gravity sets in. However, that's actually, if you think about it, a really simple or naive dimensional estimate. First of all, it lacks any dynamical information on the actual theory of quantum gravity whatsoever. It actually just uses constants of nature that make their appearance in other theories. And actually, it's the same combination that would enter something like quantum field theory on a curved background and not full quantum gravity. And so that's the first reason why we might be a bit doubtful about whether that is actually the scale of quantum gravity, because it doesn't depend on the particulars of the theory whatsoever. Also, combining these constants in this way and saying this is the scale of quantum gravity, that actually assumes naturalness. So that means that we are not allowed to put a very large or very small number in front of that. Now, naturalness is, of course, something that has been a guiding principle in fundamental physics for quite a while. But there are at least three observations that challenge naturalness. Nyayesh already mentioned the cosmological constant, which is 60 orders of magnitude smaller than its natural value. Similarly, the Higgs mass is quite a few orders of magnitude smaller than its natural value. And last of all, the neutron electric dipole moment, which is related to the theta parameter in QCD, that is also much, much smaller than 1. And so I would take these three observations to say that maybe naturalness is not a concept that nature actually cares about very much. And that would actually mean that if we have an estimate like that, we are allowed to put a very large or a very small number in front of it, and therefore we then actually don't know whether this number here is the correct scale. And the last thing that one can doubt about this estimate is that it says that quantum gravity really comes with just a single scale at which all of its effects come in, and that it can't be possible that there are some effects that set in at one scale and some other effects that set in at later scales. And so I would say, for all of these reasons, it actually makes sense to adopt a sort of twofold strategy when thinking about connecting quantum gravity to experiment. The first is to actually be a bit more agnostic and forget about this sort of theory prejudice here, and just ask, well, can we constrain a new physics scale, L new physics, in gravity? Can we constrain that from observations? Or how far can we actually constrain that? And then the second part of the strategy is to be, well, maybe pessimistic and say, well, maybe this order of magnitude estimate is actually not so bad. Maybe that is more or less the scale of quantum gravity. are there then any lever arms that we can find that would make Planck scale effects enhanced so that we can actually connect them to observations? And in this talk, I'll try to give you a glimpse at sort of two types of ideas. And I'll be doing that in two different testing grounds. One of them is black holes, and the other is particle physics. So let's jump right in with the first testing ground, which will be black hole shadows, that you'll hear much more about in the second talk. So when using black hole shadow observations to test black hole spacetimes, to test the Kerr paradigm, to test GR, and to constrain new physics, there's a bunch of different approaches that one can take. The first, I'll call that a parameterized approach. And what is being done here is that one writes down something like the Kerr metric and then writes down all possible deviations of that metric. And of course, that is very, very comprehensive. It will presumably encompass anything that one can actually do. However, it's quite disconnected from the fundamental theory. So even if you assume that observations will tell you that there's a bunch of deviation parameters that are actually measured to be different from what you expect them in GR, then you don't know very much what that is actually telling you about the fundamental theory. You can take sort of the opposite type of approach, which is a principled approach, where you say, I start from a very specific theory, and I calculate what the black hole shadow looks like in that theory, and then I can compare that to observations, and thereby say whether or not that theory matches observations. But of course, then to be comprehensive, you would actually have to do that in all possible theories beyond GR. And that's not only practically a little bit unfeasible, it's also a little bit of a theoretical overkill because the Event Horizon Telescope observations do have finite resolution, as I think you'll also hear more about in the second talk. And therefore, we don't actually need to know all of the details here because many of those theories will actually produce black hole shadows that are quite similar to each other. And so you can already see I'm sort of leaving a space in here to advertise a middle ground approach which I've developed together with Aaron Held. And we call it a principled parameterized approach, and we sort of try to take the best of both worlds together. So we write down a set of general principles that we believe could be relevant for a number of theories beyond GR. And then we write down families of metrics that are based on these general principles. In this way, we have both a direct connection to sort of underlying fundamental theories, but we are also more comprehensive. We are not just covering one specific theory. And I'll be telling you a little bit about that approach and how you can actually connect it to actual data from the Event Horizon Telescope. So the three principles that I'll be talking about here are regularity, locality, and simplicity. And I'll explain to you what I mean by those words in this context here. And I will do that in the spherically symmetric case. Just for simplicity, because if I write down everything for the axisymmetric case, which is also doable, but if I do that, then my equations just become way longer, and so for reasons of brevity, I'll focus on spherical symmetry here. So how does the principled parameterized approach to a spherically symmetric black hole shadow look like? It starts from the Schwarzschild metric, which has this function here in the line element, and then we upgrade that to a non-singular spacetime. So we do what we expect a reasonable quantum gravity theory should be able to do, namely to get rid of the curvature singularity. And we do that by introducing this, this parameter here, FNP. So NP stands for new physics. And now, of course, there are various ways in which you can do that. And the way we'll do that is that we focus on these three principles and implement them. The first principle is locality. And you can think of that as being inspired by effective field theory. So the locality principle says that the upgrade depends on the space-time coordinates through the local curvature scale. And there's just a unique curvature scale for Schwarzschild black holes, which is just the Kretschmann scalar. And so we make this F new physics a function of the Kretschmann scalar, and then for dimensional reasons, it then comes multiplied with the scale of new physics to the fourth power. And in here, we leave that scale of new physics free, so we're not put in this theoretical bias that that should be the Planck scale. We just leave that as a free parameter, and then we can see how much we can say about that from observations. Ruth?
Yeah, so you're not necessarily removing the horizon.
No.
No. Okay.
I will talk about the observational consequences just on the next slide. And I'm not necessarily removing the horizon. I can do that, though. You'll see. So the second principle that we then put in is regularity. So that just says that wherever this new physics comes from, it should be new physics that removes the curvature singularity. And that actually constrains how this function starts at large values of the curvature or at small values of the radii. So it has to start at least like 1/√ of the Kretschmann scalar or higher powers. And then the final ingredient here is simplicity. And simplicity says that this upgrade should introduce only a single new physics scale. And that actually means that starting from the origin here, so from the core of the black hole, where 1/√ is very small, where this function has to go to 0, like this particular power, and then at large values of the radii or very small values of the curvature, so asymptotically, this function has to go to 1. And simplicity then says that this function is not allowed to do any non-trivial stuff in between. It should just go between these two limiting cases monotonically. So it should, in particular, not introduce any local extrema, because that would introduce additional scales. Then it turns out that in the literature, there are, of course, examples of regular black holes. So some of you might be familiar with something like the Dimnikova or Hayward or Simpson-Visser mass function. I've just written them here. The details don't matter very much. These actually are all examples of corrections that satisfy these three principles and that do exactly this. The way that they differ is how quickly they approach one.
So can I ask you something?
Yeah.
So why do you say that this f being a function of local curvature is locality? Because I mean, f itself is not local observable.
No. So we are basically, the line of argument essentially goes as follows. We are sort of saying, think of an effective field theory for gravity. So then you have the terms in GR, and then you have higher order curvature terms.
Right.
And then the way to determine whether or not higher order curvature terms play a role is just looking at the local value of the curvature at a particular point. And if that is large, then you should expect deviations from GR. And this is why we are saying that this function should not be some arbitrary function of the coordinates, but that it should depend on the coordinates through the local value of the curvature. And it should be the local value at some point. It shouldn't be something that is sort of a more global property of the spacetime.
Right, but this f is a solution to some field equation.
Yeah.
So
yes.
The field equation that is modified with these higher curvature terms. But that doesn't mean that the solution would...
No, exactly. So locality really refers to how this upgrade is done. It doesn't guarantee that the underlying theory satisfies locality in a sort of in any way that we would usually have locality in field theories. Yeah. So, yes.
Am I reading this? The curvature terms in f and p, are they from the original metric?
Yeah.
Or the modified metric?
So they are from the original metric. So it's really just the statement, you sort of look at a Kerr black hole, or a Schwarzschild black hole in this case, and wherever the Kretschmann scalar goes above a critical value, this is where you'll have a significant deviation from GR.
Yeah, it's a bit confusing for me, because you take a part of the metric and then...
Yeah. Then you'll construct a... So the new metric that we'll construct will have a different Kretschmann scalar, that in particular, now the Kretschmann scalar in the core of the black hole is actually capped off to a finite value. So if you go to space-time points where previously the Kretschmann scalar became very large, this is where the modifications are big and where there is now a significant deviation between the old and the new Kretschmann scalar.
There are modified gravity theories which also produce regular solutions.
Yeah. So in particular, I mean, there are examples, like for instance, Dimnikova would be an example of GR coupled to nonlinear electromagnetism that actually produces exactly this type of black hole solution. Yeah. And I believe I would have to check, but I believe that would actually be a theory where the corrections are just standard local field theory corrections, just nonlinear ones. All right. So then moving on. I told you in the beginning that this is sort of this principled parametrized approach that takes a bunch of principles, but then is sort of fairly general, but that also connects sort of more directly to fundamental theory. So then does this approach actually cover quantum gravity theories? The answer is yes. Black holes inspired by asymptotically safe gravity are, for instance, included. And for the purposes of this talk, I'll not introduce asymptotic safety. I'll just assume that you're all familiar with it. Just to reiterate the salient feature of it, the salient feature of it is that there is quantum scale symmetry above some new physics scale. And quantum scale symmetry means that something like the Newton coupling, which is a dimension-full quantity, has to scale according to its canonical dimension. So it has to fall off with 1 over k squared. K squared is a momentum scale, so an inverse length scale. And then the way to put this behavior into a black hole is to say, well, there is the Newton coupling in here, so we'll upgrade that to its scale-dependent version. And then we identify the scale exactly with the local value of the curvature, and there's a square root here just for dimensional reasons. And in this way, you'll get this this modification parameter just from this behavior of the Newton coupling, which comes out of asymptotic safety. And so this turns out to agree with one of the mass functions that I wrote on the previous slide. It actually agrees with the Hayward mass function. So this principled parameterized approach tries to be sort of fairly general and include principles that play a role, or that hopefully play a role, in various theories beyond TR, but it also covers sort of these more specific examples, namely asymptotic safety-inspired black holes.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
That K and T, that's where the change happens?
Yes.
You're not assuming that's Planck scale, but...
So here I'm just saying, let's be sort of completely theory agnostic, and let's say we don't know where that scale actually lies, and see how much we can constrain that from observations. I'll actually, just in a few slides from now, I'll set that to be the Planck scale again. But for now, I just leave that general.
So is it correct to just summarize the idea that you're saying, you're asking whether in the effective field theory, let's say, all the curvature terms become very important and totally change behavior once the curvature reaches Planck scale?
A scale that could be significantly lower or higher than that, right? Because I'm leaving that scale free. So I'm basically asking, what is the scale at which the higher order curvature
is
jump off?
The difference between looking at it this way and looking at it as just the question, if we consider the effective field theory of gravity, there would be higher curvature.
Yeah.
Each one would have a coefficient.
Yeah.
And we're testing observationally what the limits on those coefficients
yeah.
are.
Yes.
But you're imagining some very specific behavior, which actually looks like in which all the higher curvature terms, or many of them, would sort of simultaneously become important, rather than just, you know, one by one as you go up in curvature becoming important.
Yeah. So in fact, this sort of simplicity assumption basically says, well, there is just a single new scale at which new behavior sets in, and I will not have a situation where I have one curvature term becoming important out here and changing the F to become large, and then another curvature term lowers it again. So I'm sort of saying there will be one scale at which the effects, at which all of the effects which are relevant to regularized black holes kick in, and from that scale on, I'm just the behavior is just dictated by regularity.
Yeah, can I? So does this go back into the action and you solve the illusion?
No. So this is really disconnected from a dynamical principle. It's really just working at the level of the solutions, because in some sense that's all that is necessary to connect to the EHT observations. The story would be different if we wanted to connect to gravitational wave observations, where you would really have to solve dynamical equations and run big numerical simulations. But in order to connect to event horizon telescope observations, you really just need the space-time metric through which you then ray trace the null geodesics to get a shadow image. Yeah. I feel like I'm not going to get through all on point lines, but yeah.
I think these regular solutions consist with LIGO and EHT data.
So I will be getting to what EHT tells us about those just now. So if we implement what I just said, we have this new physics correction here, which it interpolates between 1 at large distances and 0 in the origin. And what you can see that what it is basically doing is you can think of it in two ways. It is either modifying the Newton coupling to be much smaller here in the core of the black hole, or it is modifying sort of the effective mass of the space-time to be much smaller in the core here. And what that actually means is that all distinct surfaces of the black hole, for instance, its horizon, but also its photon sphere, they are more compact because you're essentially somewhere here where this function has not reached one yet, and so you're looking at an effectively smaller mass. And the photon sphere, that's actually the surface in the space-time that is relevant for event horizon telescope observations. So that's the sphere that is approached by now geodesics that then wind around it and then make it out to an observer at infinity.
So would your length scale have to be the size of the black hole for this to be?
Yeah, I'll just come to that in just a second. Yeah. So the shadow is made more compact through that because the photon sphere is more compact. And so therefore, you can then actually take the shadow radius normalized to the mass of the black hole. For instance, in this case here for M87, the mass here is taken from observations of, for instance, stellar orbits, so further out. And then these blue bands, they are actually the EHT bands for that quantity. This continuous line is like the 1 sigma, and this dashed line is the 2 sigma theoretical estimate. And then you can plot this as a function of the new physics scale divided by the black hole mass. And you can do that for these different mass functions. And the error that we put in here, we're just saying it's the same relative error that the EHT has assuming GR. So we are assuming that if you would redo the EHT analysis in a different theory, the relative error would stay the same. This is what gives us these bands for these corrections. And you can see that as you increase the new physics scale, the shadow becomes more and more compact. And then you can see for the Hayward type or asymptotic safety inspired case, the systematic uncertainties or the observational uncertainties are too large to actually rule out even very large new physics scales. For the Simpson-Visser case, you can see that you're basically getting new physics scales that are an order of magnitude smaller than the black hole mass. Those are ruled out. So that goes back to Ted's question. But any new physics scale that is smaller than that or significantly smaller than that, you can see, is not constrained by observations, which really tells you that there's a lot of room in the observations for black holes to be something completely different than Kerr black holes in GR. Yeah, Ruth?
So, but surely you can restrict your new physics scale far more effectively for stellar mass black holes because, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, here we're talking about, God, I don't remember how many billions or whatever.
You're talking about, yeah.
You know, so I think
billion solar masses. Yeah.
You know, it's a great plot, mm-hmm. but I think realistically, you're right scooting over to the left-hand side.
Yeah. So two things about that. So yes, for solar mass black holes, you would get much stronger constraints. However, for solar mass black holes, you don't have shadow observations. You only have gravitational wave observations.
No,
currently,
you also have observations from the accretion disk. So, I mean, potentially, you do know something about.
Yeah, already those observations suffer a lot from the sort of astrophysics dirt, right? Of that, we don't really know accretion physics that well. That becomes much worse if you rely more and more on accretion disks. And there's also one other thing to keep in mind for the comparison between solar mass and supermassive black holes. If you assume that you can constrain the scale in the same way from these different observations, you're assuming that the theory beyond GR has some form of uniqueness theorem, so that any black hole solution will actually be uniquely given by a unique solution, just as we have in GR, where there's a Kerr solution. And if we go to theories beyond GR, we already actually know that black hole uniqueness no longer holds.
That's what you're doing there, though, isn't it, really, by putting that specific F of R?
Oh, I'm saying this is what is relevant to do for supermassive black holes, right? So, yeah, you could then do the same constraint for solar mass black holes in some other way, but you would have to keep in mind that it's not necessarily the correct thing to then take the stronger constraint from the solar mass black holes and say, okay, so therefore we already know that EHT observations of supermassive black holes will not discover anything. That's a conclusion that relies on saying there is some form of black hole uniqueness in the theory beyond GR. And
yeah,
that might not be true.
I expect that if it was going to be more diverse, it would be the impact of that diversity would be stronger for the smaller black holes. At least that's my.
It might depend on the formation history, right? I mean, so assume you don't have black hole uniqueness.
Yeah.
Then which branch of the solution you get to might depend on the formation history, which is quite different for solar mass than for supermassive black holes. But I mean, I'm basically just saying we know very little about what the true nature of black holes is. So we just have to be careful about the assumptions that we put in.
So there are two observations of the mass that we set star.
Yeah.
And one is about 6.3 times 10 to the 9 solar masses.
Mm-hmm.
And that's 3.5 times 10 to the 9 solar masses. The first one depends on stellar dynamics, dark matter. And the second one depends on the gas.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so one of them is actually consistent with EHT.
3.5.
Yeah, no, I'm following what the EHT collaboration is doing, where they agree more with the larger one. So
right.
This is the one I'm taking here.
So John, let me. I think maybe we could come back to this later because I feel you're being asked to deliver too much.
Sorry, right.
No, no worries. There's also, going back to Ruth's former question, if you make the new physics scale large enough beyond some critical value, this is why these curves stop here, there the horizon is actually resolved. And that is because these solutions generically have two horizons, one that lies where it usually lies, so at 2gm. And because this function here goes to zero at small radii, you have another zero of the Laplace function, which gives you another horizon. And so if you go beyond the critical value, the image will change quite significantly. And I'm showing you this here just in a cross-section through the image. So I'm looking at a black hole image along this axis here, and I'm just showing you the normalized intensity, which is quite low in the core, and then it jumps to some finite value. And here, just at the shadow boundary, this is where you have a stack of photon rings. And now what happens if we make the new physics scale large enough is that inner photon rings show up because the horizon is resolved. These inner photon rings arise because the photon sphere can still be there. There is still strong gravitational lensing, and geodesics wind about the photon sphere from the inside. Those are the geodesics that for a black hole end up behind the horizon. If you resolve the horizon, they can make it outside. And you can see that now you have a very distinct image. You don't have the shadow anymore. You have intensity peaks in the center. In order to answer the question whether or not the EHT can actually distinguish this case, I'll actually go to the spinning case, and we'll then come back to that question.
What do you mean by the horizon is resolved?
So the horizon is by the horizon is resolved. I just mean that there is no longer a horizon, and the way that this happens mathematically is the horizons are the zeros of this function, and with this modification you have two zeros. That as you crank up the scale of the modification, these two approach each other, and there's a critical value where there's no longer a real zero, but it just moves off into the complex plane. That's what I mean by resolving. So I don't mean a physical process, I just mean sort of the mathematical meeting of these two solutions. All right, so let's go to the spinning case to answer this question whether or not we can distinguish these cases. And the spinning case is interesting because there we can focus on the case where the new physics scale is actually equal to the Planck scale. So why is that? That is because spin can actually act as a lever arm to enhance Planck size effects. And the way that this works is as follows. What I'm showing you here is a metric function, the zeros of which determine where you have the horizon. As you increase the spin in a curved black hole, you get an inner Cauchy horizon. And as you increase the spin more and more, they approach each other. And if you would increase the spin beyond one, then you would resolve the horizons. And you would leave behind a naked singularity. And this is why we believe that in GR, that process cannot happen due to cosmic censorship. So in GR, we believe that the spin cannot become larger than one. But now if we add the quantum gravity effect, that will regularize the black hole. So there is no longer, so cosmic censorship no longer applies. And in particular, if you are in a situation where the spin is nearly one, then even a tiny correction from quantum gravity, so really just a Planck scale correction, is enough to lift this function above the axis so that there are no zeros anymore. And so the combination of spinning very, very fast together with a tiny Planck scale quantum gravity effect is then enough to resolve the horizon. So in this way, spin acts as a lever arm to enhance Planck scale effects. As a caveat, I should say that it's unclear whether astrophysical black holes can actually reach the spins close to one that are required. In GR, it is believed that that cannot happen in any physical process. In dynamics beyond GR, that question is not comprehensively answered. So we'll just assume that this might be happening. What happens then is that a black hole shadow lights up. So this is the shadow of a black hole spinning very fast, but still a black hole. And then adding a tiny correction, which actually here we've made quite large just for numerical reasons to be able to ray trace. But you can actually imagine that the difference between this number and this number is really just the ratio of the Planck scale to the mass of the black hole. And what happens then is that these inner photon rings appear in the image. So this is what we called a black hole shadow lighting up. And you would say, well, by eye, these images clearly look very, very different. So for sure, the EHT is able to tell us that this is not what we are looking at. So that's actually not necessarily the case. So asking the question whether the next generation EHT or the current EHT can distinguish black holes and horizonless spacetimes. And so this is work together with Aaron Held and also with Roman, who will also talk next. So we took these two simulated images and we put them through a simulated observation with the sparse EHT array. And you can see by eye that they actually produce quite similar images. The main reason is that the EHT resolution is just enough to resolve scales that are the entire size of the shadow, but the resolution is just not enough to resolve smaller structures. And actually, you can obviously analyze the similarity of these images just beyond looking at them by eye. You can actually look at the data in the Fourier plane as is appropriate for these type of observations. And you can conclude that the EHT cannot distinguish this image from this image. And so we don't actually know whether what the EHT is seeing is something like this.
Yeah? What is that gray area in the middle?
Oh.
The gray is.
So in these spacetimes here, the modification is such that you're getting a wormhole geometry. And so then there are geodesics that would originate in another asymptotic area. And we say, let's be completely agnostic. We don't want to put any bias on what is actually coming from that other simulator, from that other asymptotic area. And so all geodesics in the actual image plane that come from that other asymptotic area are just in this gray zone. So you're basically, depending on what you put, in terms of light sources into that other asymptotic region, you could get different cores in that case. All right, so then the EHT is obviously not the final story. There's also a next generation event horizon telescope that is currently in its planning stages that will have more telescopes and that will have increased resolution. So you can see that here, the photon ring is becoming sharper, or the boundary of the shadow is becoming sharper. But it will also have increased dynamic range. Dynamic range is something that you might be familiar with from photography. It's basically the difference between the brightest and the darkest image in a pixel. And clearly, if you want to be able to see that, say that you're looking at a black hole, you want the dynamic range to be large, because then there is a big difference between no intensity in here and lots of intensity on the boundary. And so, in fact, you can quantify that. You can define a quantity that looks at the sort of the flux in the dark region, and then the mean flux in the ring. And this ratio here, you can then look at that for the case of a black hole. And you see that as you go from EHT 2017 configuration to 2022, which already has more telescopes, to then next generation EHT, in particular combining two different frequencies, you see that that number just continues to go down further and further, as you would expect for a black hole. And for the case of a horizonless spacetime, you can sort of already see by eye that this is more black than this. And you can quantify that, and you see that this ratio here, that it just plateaus at a particular number. And in the multi-frequency NGEHT case with an optimistic number of new telescopes, you can clearly distinguish also within the systematic uncertainties whether you're looking at a horizonless spacetime or a black hole. So, in summary, what that means that, is that we do know that GR breaks down for black holes, and we are now starting to constrain where that happens. So we can, from observations, constrain new physics scales. And we can even build scenarios where quantum gravity effects at the Planck scale, so very, very tiny, would lead to big observational effects. And the NGEHT will be able to tell us something about those. All right, so now I've spent a little bit more time than planned on my first testing round, namely black holes. Let me try to be brief on the second testing round on particle physics. And I'll probably just convey the main idea to you and then skip over the more specific examples. So the second testing round, particle physics, here I'll focus on the case that the new physics scale really is the Planck scale. And so then, again, I need some form of lever arm that will make the tiny effects observable. I do have 12 more minutes until the question time is up, right?
And the rest is Roman's time, so yeah. you can negotiate this.
All right. So I'll just take 5 more minutes so that there's some time for questions. Mm-hmm. So the lever arm that I will use to enhance Planck scale effects to something that is observationally accessible is the logarithmic running of couplings in particle physics. And in order to explain the idea to you, I'll actually be using an analogy. And the analogy works as follows. Assume that the microscopic model that we are interested in is not quantum gravity, but it's a microscopic model of a bunch of different molecules. And then assume that the scale that we have access to is not particle physics scales at the LHC, but is sort of everyday scales on the order of sort of centimeters or meters. So then you would say, well, what usually happens if you start from these microscopic models and you zoom out all the way to these large scales, the microscopic information on the difference between these molecules gets lost, and you end up with just hydrodynamic descriptions in both cases. And so therefore, from these macroscopic scales, you can no longer say which of the two microscopic models was correct. And that's sort of the picture that we usually have in mind if we think about the relation of quantum gravity to particle physics. So if we start with quantum gravity models that we usually assume are very different at microscopic scales, but actually note the asterisk over here. But let's assume that they are very different. We usually assume that as we zoom out, all of that microscopic information is lost, and we just end up with the standard model of particle physics at LHC scales, and we cannot use any data here to conclude back on which was the correct underlying model. Now, let me actually challenge that expectation by going back to the microscopic model. So it's actually not true that all of the microscopic information gets lost, just most of it. And there are imprints of microphysics at these macro scales. And a good example to think about is the viscosity. So the viscosity arises directly from these different microscopic interactions between the molecules. So it's a quantity that is directly determined by the microphysics. But the viscosity, measuring that, is actually something that you can do in an undergraduate lab. So you can measure that at everyday scales. Right? And so if you can calculate the viscosity in the microscopic model and measure it at much larger scales, then you can conclude back which of these two models was correct. And that's the idea that we'll have for particle physics and quantum gravity. So we need to identify which couplings in or beyond the standard model are sensitive to the microphysics. And there are basically two types of couplings in a particle physics theory. There are those couplings that are higher order, and they actually exhibit something that is called universality. That means that even if you start with different values here at the Planck scale, so values as different as 0 all the way to 2, they very quickly get drawn onto one universal curve. And then at scales that correspond to LHC observations, you can no longer distinguish which of these microscopic values you started from. So that sort of follows the standard idea that the microphysics, that a lot of the microscopic information gets washed out. But then there are couplings that depend on the scale only logarithmically. And here you can see if we just vary the Planck scale value somewhat, we get a different value at LHC scales. And so these preserve a sort of memory of the initial conditions at the Planck scale. And so then the only non-trivial thing that we'll have to do is to identify whether or not quantum gravity constrains some of these couplings at the Planck scale. So the idea is that if quantum gravity fixes some of the couplings in the standard model, so here I'm showing you a bunch of the gauge couplings, Yukawa couplings, Higgs quartic coupling in the standard model. So if quantum gravity fixes some of them at the Planck scale, then from these initial conditions, you can just calculate using standard renormalization group flows, what the low energy value accessible at the LHC is. And so in this way, you can test the quantum gravity prediction. And also, you're doing something for particle physics, because in particle physics, the values of all of those couplings are free parameters. We just have to take them from experiment. So if you can predict them from an underlying theory, then you're eliminating some of these free parameters. And there are two examples that I had planned to talk about that I will now basically skip. One is asymptotically safe quantum gravity, and the other is causal set quantum gravity. So let me just spend 1 minute on each of those examples. In asymptotic safety, the idea is that you have scale symmetry beyond the Planck scale, and demanding this additional symmetry is something that constrains the values of some of the couplings at the Planck scale, and then from there you can map them to low energies. And I'll not go into the mechanism how that happens. I'll just flash the list of couplings in the standard model for which it has been shown that such a mechanism works. It's not all couplings in the standard model, so you don't get predictions for all of the free parameters, just for some of them. And let me skip through that example for the Yukawa couplings and go to my second example, which is causal set quantum gravity. So causal set quantum gravity is quite a different approach. It's discrete. It's Lorentzian. And the thing that we use is that you can write down what the propagator for a scalar field looks like and how it's affected by the discreteness. And this propagator has a different behavior in the UV. And so what I did together with one of my postdocs, Gustavo De Brito, and also a master's student who recently handed in her thesis, Ludivine Fausten, and work that will hopefully appear on the archive in the not-too-distant future, is we looked at exactly the setting where we have this causal set-inspired propagator that behaves different in the UV, up to some non-locality scale that will be a free parameter, and then below that, all of the effects of discreteness are invisible, so you're just getting back to standard quantum field theory. And then what we did is we asked what the effect of that will be on the quartic coupling of a scalar field. And I'll not walk you through the mechanism. Let me just say that the quartic coupling of a scalar field directly relates to the mass of that scalar in a symmetry broken regime. So this is how the quartic value of the quartic Higgs coupling is related to the Higgs mass. And so what we find is that in causal sets, this Landau pole that you have in that setting persists. And in this way, you can derive an upper bound on the scalar mass that depends on the discreteness or this non-locality scale that you put into the theory. And if you then upgrade that setting to go just beyond a single scalar field to really look at the standard model Higgs, then there will be, following the exact same type of idea, an upper bound on the Higgs mass as a function of rho. Rho is this non-locality scale, a free parameter in causal sets. And in this way, we can then constrain that scale in causal sets. So another example where you can use particle physics observations to say something about an underlying quantum theory of gravity.
Yeah? No one has ever measured the quartic coupling. It's the problem is that you need to have Higgs decaying to 3 Higgs through a virtual Higgs.
Yeah.
And they've looked at this. If you calculate the scattering amplitude, the amplitude, it's 1,000 times smaller than decay products.
Yeah.
You can't see it. No one's ever measured it.
Yeah. So we know it indirectly if we believe the standard model through the Higgs mass. But if we wanted to actually know the quartic coupling through direct measurements, that would be one of the arguments why you would need something like an E plus E minus collider, where you could actually measure these processes more directly. Let me, in view of time, skip everything I wanted to say about asymptotic safety and the dark sector. Feel free to ask me about it in the coffee break. And let me just summarize. So I started my talk by saying it's absolutely necessary to connect theory and observations in all areas of physics, and that includes quantum gravity. And then I said, well, how should we go about that? We need to be a little bit more agnostic what the scale of quantum gravity or new physics in gravity actually is. And so we can then use observations of black hole shadows to start constraining that scale. We can also use shadow observations to constrain new physics effects, even if they are confined to the Planck scale. And then we can also use particle physics data at the LHC to also constrain underlying quantum gravity theories. So with that, I apologize for taking up quite a bit of the time, and thank you for your attention.
Yeah, in the case where you looked at the A over M 1 plus 10 to the minus 6, mm-hmm. that assumed the new physics was the Planck scale?
Yeah, so we, I mean, these images were done for 1 plus 10 to the minus 6 instead of 1 minus the ratio of Planck scale over the black hole mass, just for numerical reasons.
Okay.
So the shadow image is basically the same for those. It's just much, much harder to numerically ray trace if you really have just a Planck scale correction.
Well, my question is, why didn't you take the agnostic approach and just put in some new physics scale? Why does it have to be Planck?
Ah, so you can do the same thing with a larger new physics scale. And then if you make the scale larger and larger, at some point you'll dissolve the photon sphere and these photon rings move around. The story about whether or not the EHT can distinguish doesn't change for these cases. So at the level of the current observations, they are sort of all the same because the resolution is not enough to resolve these inner rings here. We focus on the example of Planck scale new physics to say that even if the scale of new physics in black holes is the Planck scale, if you go to near critical spin, you can still enhance the quantum gravity effect to make a clearly sort of...
Even if
if it's the Planck scale, there's a dramatic observational effect.
But I guess I would have thought you could constrain LNP in some way, that if it's too big, then the EHT would definitely say...
So the interesting thing is that the EHT really at the moment, because both the resolution and the dynamic range are not sufficient, the EHT cannot rule out these cases where you have these inner photon rings. And so if you make the new physics scale much larger, the morphology of the image changes somewhat, so where exactly those inner photon rings lie, but the key property doesn't change.
Okay.
And so none of these cases are currently constrainable. It will become much more exciting.
LNP could be anything based on this.
Yeah. So it will become much more interesting with the next generation EHT.
Ruth has a very great name.
So first of all, thanks, Astrid. Great talk. But you're assuming there that like this, the effect of this F is like a quantum gravity effect, yeah? But in essence, what F does is sort of reduce the effect of mass. So mm-hmm. wouldn't that be the same if there was some sort of condensate around a black hole that therefore took up some of the mass and reduced the sort of central core mass of the black hole? So mm-hmm. am I correct in just saying that would give the same phenomena as what you're doing here? I mean, it's probably still new physics for sure, but maybe not quantum gravity.
Yeah, it's true that it's not necessarily quantum gravity because, as you're saying, anything that sort of reduces the effective mass or that changes the space-time metric in such a way that you can write the change as an effective radius-dependent mass, anything will do that. So also if you have some form of sort of dark matter cloud around that, there are, as I've advertised, sort of quantum gravity theories that give rise to the same or that inspire the same type of physics. Uh-huh. But if there was a sort of a detection of such a deviation made, then that would be a very interesting story to go into.
And a starting point.
So the degeneracy between, for instance, dark matter distributions and modifications of the space-time due to fundamental physics.
Right.
So that would be a terrific thing to analyze if there was a detection of such a deviation.
Yeah, I was wondering if you have taken a look at these soliton stars and the corresponding photon rings made by Bahr and Heidemann recently.
No, I haven't.
So they get things which from outside the photon rings looks just like the photon rings of that you observe,
mm-hmm.
but they are completely non-singular solutions to GR.
Mm-hmm.
They're complete solitons. Okay, I just thought you might.
No, I hadn't looked at that. Thanks.
Yeah.
I think the strongest constraints on the R squared term in the action come from laboratory experiments.
Mm-hmm. I think that's correct.
Black holes.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
I think that the statement is correct. I think it probably makes some assumption about whether or not the next higher order terms are natural or not, right? Because if you assume that the coefficients of that, those are unnaturally large, then I think the story of those constraints and of these constraints changes. But yeah, I think if you make the assumption that there's naturalness in the effective feed theory, then the R squared couplings, I think, are most strongly constrained by labs.
So
the order of 10 to the 60 or so not very strongly.
But so here, I guess I don't really understand the philosophy behind your approach if you're also assuming one scale. Why don't you take the viewpoint that, well, we already have from laboratory experiments much stronger constraints on this any possible effect than we would ever get from black holes. So why are we doing this?
So I'm not sure whether the lab experiments, what they actually would say, or in what sense you can translate them to all of the terms in the effective feed theory. So I know that they constrain the R squared couplings, I think under the assumption that the next couplings are all natural.
But if you would say
that, for instance, the R squared couplings are of order one, but then there is a new physics scale that is much bigger and that makes the R cubed couplings very, very large, right? Then that, I think in that case, the lab constraints would have to be re-examined,
right,
and then you could.
Is, I thought you were also only assuming one scale. Are you?
So I'm assuming that there is one scale that is relevant for black hole solutions, right? So because I'm not writing a dynamics here, I'm not necessarily saying that the full dynamics just has a single scale, but that the scale that makes that is important for black holes, that is a simple
right.
one, a single
the
exact
one. Same assumption, yeah. You're already getting constraints that are stronger from laboratory.
So, I mean, I'm not sure you can really translate those into R squared constraints. Because if you look at black hole solutions in the R squared theory, right, then you're finding that the only stable solutions are those of GR. And so you would say that no matter what the size of the curvature squared couplings, in something like stellar gravity, the stable solutions, you expect them to be exactly GR black holes. And so then, no matter whether the constraints are large or small, you wouldn't see any modification.
Yeah.
So this would then say this is not stellar gravity in some sense.
Yeah, I don't think that avoids the issue because.
Okay, I think I have to think about that more. I think it does, but yeah.
Maybe we should discuss in discussions and coffee and maybe much farther beyond any time we have actually. But if there are no other burning questions, let's. Other than John, but I think we have to move on. But let's actually move on. Thanks, Sandra.